So today we are looking at 1 Kings, starting from chapter 5 to chapter 8. But I won't be reading all of that, so I'll skip through the chapters. So first of all, we'll start with 1 Kings chapter 5, verses 1 to 6, which is on page 340 of the Church Bibles, if you'd like to follow. Preparations for building the temple. When Hiram, king of Tyre, heard that Solomon had been anointed king to succeed his father David, he sent his envoys to Solomon, because he had always been on friendly terms with David. Solomon sent back this message to Hiram. You know that because of the wars waged against my father David from all sides, he could not build a temple for the name of the Lord his God, until the Lord put his enemies under his feet. But now the Lord my God has given me rest on every side, and there is no adversary or disaster. I intend, therefore, to build a temple for the name of the Lord my God, as the Lord told my father David, when he said, Your son, whom I put on the throne in your place, will build the temple for my name. So give the orders that cedars of Lebanon be cut for me. My men will work with yours, and I will pay your men whatever wages you set. You know that we have no one so skilled in felling the timber as the Sidonians. And now we go to chapter 6, verses 1 to 10. Solomon builds a temple. In the 480th year after the Israelites had come out of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, in the month of Ziv, the second month, he began to build the temple of the Lord. The temple that King Solomon built for the Lord was 60 cubits long, 20 wide, and 30 high. The portico at the front of the main hall of the temple extended the width of the temple, that is 20 cubits, and projected 10 cubits from the front of the temple. He made narrow clerestory windows in the temple. Against the walls of the main hall and inner sanctuary, he built a structure around the building, in which there were side rooms. The lowest floor was 5 cubits wide, the middle floor 6 cubits, and the third floor 7. He made offset ledges around the outside of the temple so that nothing would be inserted into the temple walls. In building the temple, only blocks dressed at the quarry were used, and no hammer, chisel, or any other iron tool was heard at the temple site while it was being built. The entrance to the lowest floor was on the south side of the temple. A stairway led up to the middle level and from there to the third. So he built the temple and completed it, roofing it with beams and cedar planks. And he built the side rooms all along the temple. The height of each was 5 cubits, and they were attached to the temple by beams of cedar. Now we go to chapter 7, verses 13 and 14. The temple furnishings. King Solomon sent to Tyre and brought Huram, whose mother was a widow from the tribe of Naphtali, and whose father was a man of Tyre and a craftsman in bronze. Huram was highly skilled and experienced all kinds of bronze work. He came to King Solomon and did all the work assigned to him. And now chapter 8, verses 1 to 14. The ark brought to the temple. Then King Solomon summoned into his presence at Jerusalem the elders of Israel, all the heads of the tribes and the chiefs of the Israelite families, to bring up the Ark of the Lord's Covenant from Zion, the city of David. All the men of Israel came together to King Solomon at the time of the festival, in the month of Ethanim, the seventh month. When all the elders of Israel had arrived, the priests took up the Ark, and they brought up the Ark of the Lord and the tent of meeting, and all the sacred furnishings in it. The priests and Levites carried them up, and King Solomon and the entire assembly of Israel that gathered around him right before the ark, sacrificing so many sheep and cattle they could not be recorded or counted. The priests then brought the Ark of the Lord's Covenant to its place in the inner sanctuary of the temple, the most holy place, and put it beneath the wings of the cherubim. The cherubim spread their wings over the place of the ark and overshadowed the ark and its carrying poles. These poles were so long that the ends could be seen from the holy place in front of the inner sanctuary, but not from outside the holy place. And there they still are today. There was nothing in the ark except the two stone tablets that Moses had placed in it at Horeb, where the Lord made a covenant with the Israelites after they came out of Egypt. When the priests withdrew from the holy place, the cloud filled the temple of the Lord. And the priests could not perform their service because of the cloud, for the glory of the Lord filled this temple. Then Solomon said, "The Lord has said that he will dwell in a dark cloud. I have indeed built a magnificent temple for you, a place for you to dwell forever." While the whole assembly of Israel was standing there, the king turned round and blessed them.
Thanks, Candy. Morning. Well, my name is Tom. I'm on the staff team here at Fairfield. If you're here for the first time, I hope you feel very welcome. Please do make yourself known to us after the service. We are in a series on in Kings, and we've got to chapters 5 to 8, at the point where Solomon is building and dedicating God's temple. If you were here last week, you will have heard about how Solomon was the wisest man who ever lived. And so now, of course, you'll be thrilled at the prospect of receiving my wisdom for about the next 3.5 hours. This is actually the last sermon I will ever deliver as a Fairfield employee. Who said hooray? Who's that? So, I've made sure it's the best sermon I've ever written. So, look forward to it. With that in mind, we're not going to really bother with 1 Kings 5. Solomon calls up his pal Hiram, king of Tyre, for a load of materials, and he pays him and gives him a load of food and stuff. So you can muse over your Sunday lunch as to whether our worship should provide kind of practical nourishment for our communities and things like that. But we're going to sketch through chapter 6 and 7. We're going to take a few things from chapter 8, but we're also going to need to go to Chronicles, Exodus, Deuteronomy, a few other places. So if you've got a brown church Bible, or if you can see one, then grab it and keep it open. We're going to dart around a bit. If I was listening to me this morning, there's a chance I'd get confused and kind of switch off. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to try and go slow. I'm going to try and make as much sense as possible. If we want to read something together, I'll tell us the page number and the references and all of that. And some of the stuff I'll say myself. Basically, we're going to look at three things. What did it take to build the temple? What was the point of building the temple? And what implications does that have for us and our relationship with God today? So that's kind of where we're going. So we're starting on page 341 of the Church Bibles, chapter 6. It's called Solomon Builds the Temple, which always gives me a little picture of Solomon with kind of a hammer and a chisel and a paintbrush or something like this. And of course, the Bible doesn't help my cause, because he spends the whole time saying, oh, he lined the interior walls, he partitioned off 20 cubits, he prepared the inner sanctuary. Now, I'm not an exegetical expert, but I'm pretty sure it means that his workforce did it on his behalf. Okay, so let's just get that bit straight first. So let's set the scene. We're going to spend a few minutes wondering what it might have took to build and how much it might have cost. So we can see throughout the whole of chapter 6, it takes him 7 years. Have a look at verse 38 of chapter 6. And he spends twice as long building his own palace. Maybe because it was bigger. And then in chapter 7 from verse 13, there's a whole load of bronze work that this guy called Huram does to furnish the temple with so much bronze that it can't actually be measured. Well, they don't bother measuring it. I mean, think of that. In 1 Chronicles 29, don't go there, but we're going to in a second, they managed to measure 3,400 tons of iron. Now, that is equal to about 1,700 small elephants, right? So if they're using so much bronze that it can't even be weighed, that's a lot of elephants. That's a lot of iron and bronze. We'll get to the gold in a second, but just come with me now. Look at 1 Kings 7, page 344. I tried to find some generation game music like the conveyor belt, but we're just going to go through the whole inventory of the temple to see what they actually did. We start at verse 41, okay? Keep up with me. Two pillars, two capitals on top, two sets of decoration for the capitals, 400 bronze pomegranates, 10 stands, a bronze sea, wait for this, that held 9,700 gallons, which, in petrol terms, is enough to drive 339,500 miles, or, if you prefer, 13 times around the earth. So it's a big sea that holds a lot of stuff. And then there's 12 bronze bowls for the sea to rest on, bronze pots, shovels, and sprinkling bowls. And then we get to the gold a little way down, a golden altar, golden table, golden lampstands, gold floral work, gold lamps, gold tongs, gold dishes, gold wick trimmers and sprinkling bowls and censers, gold sockets for the doors and the doors for the main temple. Basically, it's a lot of stuff. It's a lot of work. It takes 7 years, and now I'm going to take you into the world of Friday nights at Fairfield and our kids' club launchpad, where we looked at the building of the temple a little while ago. In 1 Chronicles 22, this is page 426, so you might want to go there because you might not believe me. I didn't even believe me when I read it. We see the amount of gold and silver that David has put aside for Solomon to build the temple. 1 Chronicles 22, and he starts at verse 14. David basically provides 3,450 metric tons of gold and 34,500 tons of silver. Then in 1 Chronicles 29, a few pages later, we see David and the people providing an additional 270 tons of gold and 585 tons of silver. So all in all, the gold and the silver, we'll only look at that because it's a bit much to take in otherwise, the gold and the silver, 3,720 tons of gold and 35,085 tons of silver. Where's Philip Watson? You're not allowed to play this next bit. And where's Joe? Is Joe Wilcox here? He's not allowed either. Right, so does anybody want to guess how much money that is today? A quadrillion. That's quite a lot of money. That is actually more than it was. Okay, I'll give you a clue. This is what we did at Launchpad. The amount of gold and silver was enough to buy 10 of the world's most expensive private islands. 191 times. So the figure actually comes to about, it's just a ballpark, but it's roughly 97,892,725,695 pounds, and if you like, 45 pence. Again, that is without the iron, the bronze, the wood, the stones, the materials, everything else that it took to build it. That's the materials conservatively priced. Then there's two recorded instances of animal sacrifice in these chapters. 1 Kings 8:63 of 22,000 cattle. That's actually half a cattle for some reason. 22,000 cattle and 120,000 sheep and goats. And another earlier where there's so many that you can't record them or count them. So if they can count 142,000, it must have been 284,000 at least. If we look at chapter 5, which I know we've skipped, but we'll just go back. 30,000 Israelite workers, 70,000 stone carriers, 80,000 stone cutters, and 3,330 foremen over them, because the cutters and the carriers were forced labor, which is a story for another day. But in this whole process, in the process of building the temple, we get about 97 billion quid, at least 284,000 animals, countless man hours from the labor force, and 182,000 of them. And then in 2 Chronicles chapter 7, we see that when Solomon has finished it and he's dedicated and he's finished praying, have a listen to this. When Solomon finished praying, fire came down from heaven and consumed the burnt offering and the sacrifices, and the glory of the Lord filled the temple. The priests could not enter the temple of the Lord because the glory of the Lord filled it. When all the Israelites saw the fire coming down and the glory of the Lord above the temple, they knelt on the pavement with their faces to the ground, and they worshipped and gave thanks to the Lord, saying, "He is good. His love endures forever. So, hopefully we can see that in God's mind, the temple is a pretty big deal. And he condones the whole thing by coming down in fire and a cloud and smoke, and everybody's on their faces, and it's a pretty massive moment in the history of Israel. So that's just a little bit about the context of the temple and what it took to build. But I wanted to step back and go, okay, fair enough, it's expensive and it's kind of impressive, but what was the point? What was the point in the whole thing? Because there's some pretty, I think, devastating things that God says in the context of all this activity and money and splendor and work that we'll touch on in a second. And some massive implications for theology today. So to understand the point of the temple, we need to know a little bit about the layout. You've probably heard this, you might have heard this before. The temple was similar to the tabernacle, which was kind of the tent version that they made while they were in the desert. And in kind of the most inner place in the temple, there was this called the Holy of Holies. So I'm guessing that was pretty holy. And then within the Holy of Holies, there was this box called the Ark of the Covenant, which is there, just a little box. And the Ark of the Covenant was so holy within the Holy of Holies that people were known to have died when they touched it, when they shouldn't have. I think it's 1 Samuel 6, a guy called I can't remember. He has a funny name, but he dies because he touches it when he shouldn't have, which is all very sad. And then within the ark, which is the holiest box maybe in the world, in the holiest place, in the holiest temple, in the holiest of holies, there's basically nothing except 2 stone tablets. 1 Kings 8:9. Nothing except the tablets. On which God had written the law, the Ten Commandments, the rules basically that he wanted everybody to keep. So what was the point of the temple? All of it, every aspect, all the work, all the money, all the time, all the effort, all the gold and the animals, was so that the rules and the laws that God wanted his people to keep could be obeyed completely and diligently as a sign to the world, this is how you worship God. Have a listen to this, 1 Kings 6:12. God says to Solomon, as for this temple you're building, if you follow my decrees, carry out my regulations, and keep all my commands, and obey them, I will fulfill through you the promise I gave to David your father, and I'll live among the Israelites and not abandon my people Israel. So in one moment, God basically says, nice temple, Solomon. I realize it's going to take, you know, 100 billion quid and loads of work and loads of hours. But really, the most important thing is that you obey me. That's the deal, basically. And then he takes it even further. I want you to read this with me. Go to 1 Kings 9:4-9. And in the Bibles, it's page 347. We're going to start at verse 4, because this is serious. So this is after all the work is finished, everything's done, again, it's been dedicated, Solomon's prayed. God says to Solomon, as for you, if you walk before me faithfully with integrity of heart and uprightness, as David your father did, and do all I command and observe my decrees and laws, I will establish your royal throne over Israel forever. As I promised David your father when I said you shall never fail to have a successor on the throne of Israel. But, if you or your descendants turn away from me and do not observe the commands and decrees I've given you and go off and serve other gods and worship them, then I'll cut off Israel from the land I've given them and I will reject this temple I've consecrated for my name. Solomon, I know I've consecrated it myself. I've come down in fire. I've come down in smoke. It's a pretty big deal. Just so you know, I do not have a problem rejecting it completely if you do not obey me. This 100 billion pound very holy temple will become a heap of rubble. A heap of rubble. All who pass by will be appalled and will scoff and say, why has the Lord done such a thing to this land and to this temple? People will answer, because they have forsaken the Lord their God who brought their ancestors out of Egypt and have embraced other gods, worshipping and serving them. That's why the Lord has brought all this disaster on them. Right, here's the main thing that I think I need to say this morning. All that other stuff was hopefully a run-up and a bit of context and stuff we needed to know. The main thing is this. Relationship with God is conditional. It isn't free, and it isn't cheap, and it isn't easily attainable. And there are millions, it seems, of hoops that you have to jump through to be able to know and serve and love the God of the universe. So, we know what did it take to build the temple. We know what the point of the temple was. I just want to focus for the last little bit on one little strand of theology, which is so important in this. And it's the theology that you might even think yourself. You've certainly heard it. And it is, I'm a good person. Me and God are probably pals. I'll probably make it to heaven. We've heard that before. There's probably some people here who think it. So if that's you this morning or you've heard it, allow me, if you will, just for a few minutes to take you through a little, just a bit of a checklist to figure out whether or not this theology that people have or that you have will work out in reality. So, you're a good person. That's great. Let's just make sure. I touched on this in the carol service last month. Have a look first at the Ten Commandments in Exodus 20, which God gave having descended in fire and a cloud and a load of smoke, if that sounds familiar. And think to yourself, have I managed to follow all of these? There's only 10 of them, so have I managed to follow these absolutely perfectly since I've been alive? And if the answer is yes, then wow, brilliant. Well done. Keep going. You maybe have a few more decades of doing them like perfectly all the time, but you're definitely on course. Okay, so that's the first thing. Second thing, after you've checked off the Ten Commandments, have a little look at Leviticus 11 to 27, and just make sure you're doing all of that, you know, perfectly as well. Just a few things for your reference. You're not allowed to eat eagles, vultures. That includes the black ones. Lucy, please. You're not allowed to eat red or black kites. That's the ones that fly, not the ones you fly. Any ravens or owls, any bats. So hopefully you're all cool with that. There's some other little stuff. Don't steal or lie or deceive one another. You know, all the easy stuff. And then once you're happy with Leviticus 11 to 27, just have a look at all the feasts and the laws in Numbers and Deuteronomy, because it's kind of important that you do all of that as well, because that's kind of one of the things that God says, this is how everyone will know that you love me and that you worship me and create community and all that lovely stuff. So if you've done all that perfectly, then you're right. Yes, you're good. In fact, you'll probably get to heaven, which I think is pretty great. For anybody else, if you kind of think, I don't know, like possibly there's a few things there that I might not have done brilliantly well, then I've got some really good news. God has made a way for you to be let off for all of your slip-ups. All of them. How good is that? So I think that's really good news. So let's just have a look at that. The first seven chapters of Leviticus. And most importantly, chapter 16, and you'll receive the instructions from God as to how you can be let off every time you do something wrong. Either for a big thing or for a little thing, he's got it all covered. There's all kinds of animal sacrifices, grain offerings, fellowship offerings, sin offerings, guilt offerings that you can do, for messing things up, you know, because we're trying to be good, but it's really hard. So have a look at that, and then don't forget, for that to work, you kind of need to build the tabernacle. But you can find instructions for the tabernacle in Exodus 25 to 40. So you don't need to panic. Just read it through and you can get on with that. The only other thing is that you should remember to track down the original stone tablets, the ones that God wrote on, because they kind of need to go in. Oh, that's the other thing. You need to build the ark. They need to go in the ark, which goes in the tabernacle, and, you know, because the tablets are really important. And again, I don't want you to feel overwhelmed by this. Don't worry. You just read through 25 to 40 of Exodus. It's all down there for you to follow and to and to sort out. A couple of other things. Levites are the only ones who are actually allowed to do it, all the tabernacle stuff. So if you don't, if you're not a Levite, or you don't know any, maybe just think about, you know, go on Facebook or something, find a Levite. You might actually find that you need to own some land for them to live in, and you have to feed them, you know, from the sacrifices that they do. You'll find it all written down. And then eventually you might want to think about upgrading the tent that you will build for a temple. Again, don't be overwhelmed. There's the instructions from our passage today, along with some ballpark figures that you might want to think about. And if you're a man, you'll have to chop the end of your willy off. I hope that's okay. So if you manage to do all of that, then you're right. You are a good person, and you can have a relationship with God. I just thought I'd clarify, you know, the conditions of the relationship. I know it seems a bit difficult, but I didn't make it up. I'm just a man. It's kind of the way God's prescribed it. And Solomon, in our passage today, Solomon knew full well how important it is, because God said, "Obey me, or I'll reject you and I'll reject the temple." And Solomon knew how seriously God took the obeying of his law. And he knew simultaneously how often him and the Israelites would mess it up, because it's basically impossible to keep God's law. And Solomon says in chapter 8, verse 31, "When anyone wrongs their neighbor and they swear towards this temple, hear and act." 33, "When we've been defeated because we've sinned against you and we make supplication towards this temple, forgive and bring them back." Verses 35, 37, 41, 44, 46, "When the heavens are shut up, when the famine and plague come, when we go to war, when the foreigner comes, when we sin against you, and then we pray towards this temple, which we've set up to specific standards, using trillions of pounds to make sure that you can forgive us, please do forgive us and act." This is what it means to be good in the sight of God. Obey the law, and if you can't, come to me for forgiveness. Not me, you know, God. Come to God for forgiveness in this specific context with these specific parameters, and we can stay in relationship. Otherwise, I'll cut you off, I'll destroy the temple, and you'll become a byword. Relationship with God is conditional. And the thing that we all really want to think is, no, that can't be right. No. God is, God's love and stuff, isn't he? God's cool. A relationship with God isn't, you know, it's not all about following the rules and doing everything perfectly. I think it is, actually. Unfortunately. And the reason we know that is because we see it confirmed when Solomon finishes the temple and he gives the whole thing over to God. And God goes, "Whoa, nice. You've set up this system. You're ready to obey me. I will dwell here in a cloud. My presence is going to be here." And you've only got to go as far as 2 Kings 17 and 25 to see that human beings, it just can't be done. It can't be done. We're not capable of being good enough. The temple gets wrecked, the people get taken away, the whole system fails. Because we just can't meet the conditions of the relationship, even when we pour in all the world's resources. And a whole community of people who on paper are saying, "Yeah, we want to follow God." It's impossible. So that's quite depressing, isn't it? What do we need? What can we do instead? I will struggle to build a new temple because I haven't got 100 billion quid. Plus, it's now a mosque, so that'll be tricky. We probably need a person who can, you know, who can perfectly obey the whole law, you know, for their whole life on our behalf. So that's going to be difficult. Then we probably need someone. We need to convince him to be sacrificed for us, like the animals in the temple. Like, even though he's never done anything wrong, because he's obeyed like the whole law. Who can we do? Who can we find willing to kind of totally sacrifice themselves on our behalf? And then... Wow, that's high praise indeed. But I think not. Let's go to Romans. Romans 10, verse 4 and 9. It says this. Christ is the end of the law. Christ is the end of the law. So that there may be righteousness for everyone who follows the rules and does all the sacrifices and worships perfectly in the billion-pound temple. I think I misread that. Christ is the end of the law, so there may be righteousness for everyone who believes. Potentially, that's a little bit easier. Potentially, that's easier. Maybe it's harder. If you confess with your mouth Jesus Christ is Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. See, relationship with God is conditional. And it wasn't cheap. And it wasn't easy. But because of Christ hanging on the cross and rising from the dead on the third day, it is free. Our only condition is to believe in the one who met all the conditions. Relationship with God is free. And then it'll cost you everything you've got. We're out of time. Let me pray, and then we're going to sing our closing song.